Hello, my name is Simon Ward, and I would like to welcome you to the Triathlon Coach podcast. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic champions and covering all distances from sprint to Ironman. Now it's my goal in this weekly 30-minute podcast to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. So as I've already said, we've got just 30 minutes, so let's get rolling with today's guest. And my guest today is the reigning outlaw champion, Kit Walker. You may actually know him as Chris, but most people refer to him as Kit Walker. So hello, Kit. How are you today?
Yeah, good, Simon. Thank you. You?
Yes, I'm very well, thanks. I'm enjoying the nice warm weather that we've been having. Are you?
Yeah, definitely. Although today's gotten a bit cloudier, but it's been a beautiful few days down here.
Yeah, it's nice and sunny now, and actually it's quite warm, but it was riding to the pool this morning was still required a gilet and some arm warmers and a thin pair of gloves at 6 a.m. It sort of warms up quite quickly, doesn't it, at the moment?
It does, when the sun comes up.
Yeah. So, Kit, you are a pro triathlete. If we see your name on an entry list for the Outlaw, for instance, it will have pro next to it. If we see you racing at a 70.3 Ironman event, you will be part of the pro field. But I know that your backstory is probably different to what most people think of as a pro. So you were telling me before that you've been racing as a pro now since 2016. When did you start off in triathlon?
I did my first sprint triathlon in April 2011.
How did that go?
It was all right. It was done on a bit of a whim with a bit of encouragement from my brother, who was coming down to race the event that was local to me. He lent me his bike and a pair of trainers, and I kind of did a little bit of training and got through it. But then pretty much decided on that day that I wanted to do another one.
So did you have a swim or a run or a bike background before that day then?
Swim, yeah. As a kid, I was a swimmer, not at a very good level, but at a club and kind of county level. And then I spent my teenage years messing around on mountain bikes, but not training as much, but just riding bikes. So.
Sounds a bit like Lionel Sanders. Didn't he spend most of his time sort of swimming and doing a bit of school running and messing around on BMX bikes?
Yeah.
It's funny, but those sort of backgrounds, you know, when you're a child and growing, learning the skills from swimming. I mean, you say you weren't a particularly good swimmer, but in comparison to most triathletes, you've probably quite a strong background as part of a club, learning those technical skills that most people find so difficult at an early age, so they get actually grooved in, and that helps when you know 2011 and onwards when you came back to triathlon, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. My swim, you know, like you say, from a technical perspective, was always pretty good. And I swam a bit as a kid up to the age of probably 12 or 13, and I spent a couple of years playing relatively competitive water polo, and then it kind of just fizzled out after that until I got back into it for triathlon.
That water polo, now that sets you up nicely for triathlon, doesn't it? Because no matter how violent people think the start of a triathlon swim is, it doesn't really compare to a competitive water polo game.
No. I can be a little bit different altogether.
I've got a couple of friends who played water polo, and they have to wear those silly caps, don't they, that protect their ears because of the close physical contact that isn't supposed to happen but does.
Yes, exactly. It isn't supposed to happen, but everyone knows it does.
Yeah, I do think that triathletes should have a go at water polo. They'd soon get over their open water anxieties once they played a game in the pool.
Yeah, and we actually always used to play water polo in the sea during the summer as well, so then you'd be killing both birds with the same stone.
Absolutely. So there's our first pro tip for the day then. Have a go at water polo, and at least even if it doesn't improve your open water, it'll get rid of your anxiety. So 2011, you did your first sprint try. How did you get on in that race? Spectacularly well or just average?
Oh, no. I survived it. I've never had a run background, so I kind of plodded through my run. And I was, I don't know what my position was, 20-something, 30-something, not competitive remotely.
Okay. How old were you then, back in 2011?
21.
Okay. So after 2011, then what did you do the next year? Did you dive headlong into triathlon? And
yeah, I did that season pretty much. I put my mountain bike up for sale and bought a road bike, and then just kind of got into it, really, doing a couple of local Olympic distance events, and then 2012 I did my first Ironman.
Ah, right. So, and when did you realise that you could be quite good at this sport?
Maybe the end of 2012. I did two full distance events and was starting to post some pretty reasonable times, I think, for the kind of experience and training I was doing.
Yeah, give us an example then of one of those times.
So I did Challenge Copenhagen, was my first Ironman or Iron Distance event, and I went 10 hours 28. And then about 2 months later, we did Challenge Barcelona, and I went 10 hours 9. I think it was.
So those are
pretty close to the 10 hour mark quite quickly.
Okay, and those are pretty similar to the Challenge Copenhagen became Ironman Copenhagen, didn't it? I think.
Yeah, and Challenge Barcelona is now Ironman Barcelona.
Okay, so pretty comparable to the times that people would be racing.
Yeah,
but nowhere near what you need to do to race as a pro athlete, though.
No, and for me, the big goal then became going under 10 hours.
Yeah, okay. Did you do that in 2013?
Yeah, Outlaw 2013, yeah.
Okay, all right. And at what point in that then did you decide that you'd be able to race as a pro and not embarrass yourself as racing as a pro?
That was at the end of 2015 that I pretty much made the decision that I was going to give it a crack.
Yeah, and what was the sort of tipping point that changed your mind then?
I'd had a top 10 overall at 70.3 Dublin.
Yes.
In the August, and I'd won my age group, and I think I was 8th or 9th overall, including the pros. And then it was Challenge Weymouth when it was the European Middle Distance Championships at the end of 2015 over the full distance. And I think I was 8th overall and the fastest age grouper. So yeah, that was kind of it ticked the box in British triathlon's eyes, and it gave me enough kind of confidence and motivation that I might be able to give it a crack.
Okay, it's always an interesting one, that, isn't it? Because there's still a step up from winning your age group and finishing amongst the top 10. There's still a step up to racing pro and performing admirably there and not getting sort of being miles behind.
Yeah, definitely, I think, and that's something I experienced pretty quickly.
Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar. You probably heard the name, but Kyle Buckingham. When we were distributing CompuTrainers, Kyle had a compu trainer, and he was working as a builder in London, and he was training in the morning and in the evening after working as a builder, so that's a tough job. And he won his age group and he got to Kona, and I think he did quite well there, and he said to me, "I'm
course record in Kona, I think, yeah, I remember seeing."
Well, he did, but before then he'd asked me about turning pro, and we had a lot of pros that we were sponsoring at compu trainer, and I'd said to him, "Do you know what, Kyle, until you can be the fastest age grouper in Kona, I wouldn't even think about it." So a couple of years later, he came back and he was the fastest age grouper, and I think he might have finished in the top 10 overall. But of course, we know, you know, racing as an age grouper, you've got a slightly different dynamic to the race than you have in the pro field. But that was the point when he turned pro. But his first two or three years in the pro field weren't filled with the success that his age group performances might have indicated, for that very reason, that there is a big step up in competition and expectation upon you.
Yeah, and I think exactly you say, you know, the dynamic of the race is different, and I think mentally you almost start to approach the races a little bit differently.
Yes. So, okay, so 2016 then, you decided you were going to race as a pro. Now, you I guess you still had a day job at that point. You still do have a day job. So how did you start to balance out those? Because it's the first years in pro triathlon aren't filled with the riches of other professional sports.
No, and I spoke to my wife and my family a little bit, and then at the end of 2015, I spoke to my boss at work and told him what I was thinking about doing, and just asked him if it would be possible to kind of either work a slightly more flexible schedule or reduce some hours out of my working schedule to take me down from a kind of full-time 40-hour a week job down to a slightly more part-time job, and they agreed for me to do it.
So how many hours were you working when they'd agreed that then, or how many hours so did I've you start done, to like, work?
Yeah, I was on a pretty typical kind of 40-hour a week working week before then, and now I just do 23.
23. Okay. And what is it you do, Kit, if you don't mind me asking?
Engineering. So I'm a CNC machinist.
Okay. So you're on your feet all day?
Yeah, I stand up all day. It's not massively physical, but I'm standing.
Yeah. Okay. Some might say that's a good thing rather than sat down all day.
Yeah.
Okay. So 2016, you turned pro. So tell us about the realities of that first year of being a pro.
I think in my head at the end of 2015, I thought it was going to be quite easy and I'd just train a whole load and I'd get much fitter and much faster and things would kind of fall into place. But actually, initially, when I tried to kind of step my training volume up because I had this extra time to train, I found the initial kind of adjustment period to that quite hard. And I'd gone from kind of training maybe like 12 hours kind of a week to trying to put in like 18, 20 plus hours a week. And it took me probably 2 months just to even get used to that.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen before that when athletes become full-time, even if they're not pro, but perhaps they go to university and they've got all this extra time on, they immediately think about how much extra training they can do. And, you know, I do wonder sometimes whether continuing with the same training or maybe just stepping it up maybe 1 or 2 hours but benefiting from the additional rest might be a different pathway for them to go. Do you, looking back on it now, do you think that might have been better or do you think that you actually did take the right path?
No, I think in hindsight, I would do a much more incremental approach and just build it 1 or 2 hours a week and just have the patience to, all right, maybe it's going to take me 3 months to get to a kind of volume that I consider, you know, what I was after, but it would probably be a better approach.
So roughly what's your weekly volume now then over an average year, do you think?
Yeah, so I probably float around the 20-hour mark, give or take, depending on the kind of time of year, the training, races, etc.
And is there anything particularly fancy about what you do? Are you do you do a lot of sort of threshold work? Are you an advocate of polarized training? Do you is it fairly mundane what you do? Just rinse and repeat.
Yeah, I think depending on my approach is generally always changing to a certain extent, depending on what I've learned and what I think I need to improve on. But I think different approaches for different times of the year is something I generally work on. So this year, I actually, for the first time, started working with a coach. So my training is now much more guided by someone else.
Yeah.
Up until then, I'd always coach myself and I kind of, would just work on different things for different kind of the years, depending on what I was targeting in the races.
Okay. How did you find that experience then, letting go of the reins and handing it over to somebody else?
Quite hard, but I knew I needed to do it because I was getting to the point where I'd make the same mistakes and I could see patterns between the end of 2016 and the end of 2017 that were, you know, I'd almost repeated the same thing. So I was like, well, I don't need to do that again. So I needed something different.
So, and are you working with a triathlon coach then or just somebody who's helping you with specific disciplines?
No, with a triathlon coach. I work with Mark Pierce at Intelligent Triathlon Training.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, I know Mark. And he's got a good following there. Is he still based in Loughborough?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So 2016 then. What was your first pro race that you participated in?
70.3 Mallorca.
Ah, okay. Nice race to start off with. Competitive though.
Yeah, massive. And there were like 60 pro guys on the start line. So.
Wow.
It was a bit of a kind of baptism of fire.
And how did that one go?
It was all right. I think I was about 20th, so it wasn't horrendous, and I had a pretty strong performance all around.
Right. So in that year, then, because it's no longer a pro race, is it? This year, the first year it was an age group race only. But who would have been racing that year? Raylett, Andreas Raylett, was he racing then?
No, it was won by Andy Dreitz.
Okay, yep.
David McNamee might have just about started racing it that year.
Yes.
Don was on the start line, but it was the year that it was really, really cold and wet.
Right, okay. So, you know, after that race then, did you think, right, well, actually, it was a good move turning pro, or were you where you expected, or did you think you'd made a mistake?
No, I was pretty happy. I think I'd beaten all the age groupers, so I hadn't been beaten by an age grouper at that point. And I was kind of like, in my head, I just had to get experience, and things just like the swim start were just so different, and it was just about learning where I could kind of improve and make steps forward.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people talk about triathlon, even at the pro end of longer distance stuff, as being a non-drafting individual race. But there is a dynamic of those races that these days seems to start coming out of the swim. The transition seems to be more like an ITU race than it ever used to be. And then there's this pack, even if it's a loose pack, of sort of trying to keep the draft distances, but still not wanting to lose that either. Did you find that? And is that what you'd expected, or was it completely different?
No, and I think the first time, as an age grouper with a strong swim and bike, I'd always ridden off the front of a race and raced by myself. And going into the kind of pro race where I'd come out of the swim, you know, in the second pack, and then I'd ride, I started to experience that kind of pack riding and that pace line riding. It was interesting.
You find it difficult not to get caught up into being on somebody's wheel and keeping that distance when there was always somebody wanting to sort of maybe push past you and drop into that gap? And, you know, then you have, you know, the rules say that you're supposed to move back at that point.
Yeah, and it's not my favourite way to race. I like to, especially on the bike, you know, I like to push the bike a little bit, and you've got to be a bit more conservative and a bit more conscious. But I think the problem is that the kind of effort it takes to get away from that kind of racing, unless you're super strong, just blow the rest of your race apart anyway.
Yeah. But it is, I remember being in Hawaii and being at a press conference, and it was when Norman Stadler was in his sort of heyday, and somebody asked Faris Al-Sultan, well, what are your tactics if Norman goes off the front again? And he said, do you know, there's no tactics. He said, if he goes, I have to try and match his pace. I can't sort of, like, you know, play strategic here. We're all here to win. And if I can go with him and I'm strong enough, then I will. And if I can't hold the pace, then I'll get beaten. Does that mean that the racing moves away from a steady state effort to more of a stochastic effort where you're having to put in big surges to keep up with people?
Yeah, and I think definitely that is one of the biggest changes of racing, kind of from an age group, which is generally a much more solo effort, to the pro race, is that you can't afford to not be in that pace line if you're there already. And like you say, if someone puts in a dig at the front, then everyone goes. If you're racing with a power meter, you can see the fluctuations.
Yeah. So you almost don't want to race with a power meter, do you? Because you'll be stuck in that bit of, well, I'm going above the red zone now, but if I don't stay with it, then I'm going to be out the back.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's why you see so many pro guys not necessarily run to their potential, because they've got moves on the bike and blown their legs apart.
Yeah, it does make you think about some guys that go to Kona with a pedigree of winning races, but they sometimes those races they've won from the front, where they can set their own pace, and when they have to respond to other people's, maybe they're not the strongest swimmers, they have to respond to somebody else's tempo, it doesn't suit them, particularly in such a hot conditions.
Yeah, I think that's right. And even watching kind of the men's and women's races in Hawaii and the different dynamics, when you can see the women put in brilliant runs and someone like Miranda Carfrae run through after riding her own steady state race 10 minutes back at the front, and the girls at the front who have tried to stay with the bike blow up. And
yeah, so in your first race then in Mallorca, you came 20th. I guess you come out near the front of the swim?
I wasn't front pack. I think I was sat in the kind of second pack.
Yeah. And then you got onto the bike, and when you'd finished, then did you feel that the difference between you and the guys in the top 10 was fitness, or was it more tactical and technical?
I think it was fitness, but more specific elements of fitness, if that makes sense, than kind of like general fitness.
Yeah.
It was the pure speed that they went off the start for, like, the first 400 meters. I just didn't have that kick in the swim. So then I missed the front pack very quickly and things like that.
Yeah.
And then my run has always been slightly lacking. So my run was always a kind of, you know, need to work on.
Okay. All right. So you did Mallorca. Just give us paint the picture of that first 2016 then. Did things improve as you went on?
Yeah, I think I made some improvements and I made some mistakes. Then I went on to race at Outlaw. which was a good one. And then it was the first year we had 70.3 Weymouth, but I punctured on the bike, which didn't help me there. So I didn't finish that race because I went on to Ironman Mallorca, but I didn't have a very good race there at all.
That, I mean, that you'd have known the course there because essentially you've got that sort of slightly undulating first lap and then you're onto the half Ironman loop for the second part and then the run's pretty similar, isn't it, along the beach and in and out of town. Flat and boring and very hot.
Yeah, and lots of laps, but we went there kind of with that mindset that, we knew the area, we knew the course and it was going to be, relatively competitive, but there would be all the real good guys would be preparing for Kona.
Yeah, and... when you're a pro and things, did you finish that race or was it a DNF?
Oh no, I finished. It was just a 10-hour race or something.
So you go to a race as a pro. You have what sort of aspirations do you have when you go there? Are you trying to gather points for Kona? Are you trying to earn prize money, or are you putting in an appearance to satisfy sponsor requirements or something else?
Yeah, for me that year, I think I generally do race for my own satisfaction, I suppose. But it was definitely to test myself against the names that were there and see what I could do and try and see how close I could get in a competitive professional Ironman.
Hmm. Have you ever been drawn to that? I mean, it's changing back again now, isn't it, to winner takes all at each race, but were you ever drawn into that Kona points ranking thing?
No, Kona is on my radar, but I've always said I'm not even going to bother going there for another 2 or 3 years at least, or even attempt to qualify for 2 or 3 years at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's there is always that sort of the pull of Kona, but it's an expensive trip if you're not finishing inside the top 10, isn't it? You definitely come back out of pocket from that one unless you've got a longer-term plan.
Yeah, definitely. And for me, the fact that I'm still the under 30, so I figured that we won't target Kona until I'm at least 30.
Yeah. Okay, so 2017, come back after Mallorca, go away, have a bit of a recovery. How much recovery do you take at the end of the season?
2 to 3 weeks, generally, at the end of the year.
Yeah, at the end of the year or the end of the season?
At the end of the season, sorry, yeah. And then actually, because I've got the family and that, I tend to take a fair bit of downtime over Christmas.
Okay. So, and in that end of season break, are you doing any triathlon related stuff, or did you sort of turn your back on triathlon and
I'll take two weeks where I generally do nothing. I won't, unless it's kind of a very light social kind of ride or a little jog or something. Generally, be no training whatsoever.
Yeah.
And then a couple of weeks, and then get back up.
Okay, so you finished the year as the outlaw champion. You'd had a reasonable introduction to pro racing, so. 2017, what were your goals and how did that work out?
2017 was about racing a little bit more in the pro field. I hadn't done many races as a kind of professional in 2016, so I wanted to do a couple more and see what happened.
Yeah, and how did it work out?
Again, a bit of a mixed bag again. I had some positives and some not very good races at all. We went back to Mallorca for the 70.3 and I had real bad back problems and ended up just jogging around the run after a really good swim, unfortunately. And then Staffordshire, I did the 70.3 there, which wasn't too bad. And it laid a good foundation for what was a better race at 70.3 Edinburgh. So I was progressing through the season and then Outlaw at the end of July.
Okay, yeah. You did. Did Gomez win Staffordshire last year?
That was the first year,
right? Okay.
Last year, I can't remember who won it, but
yeah. So. All right. And I think did you get fifth at Edinburgh?
I think I was probably closer to 10th at Edinburgh.
Okay.
Somewhere around there.
So you go to these races, Kit. There is prize money on offer, but it doesn't always stretch down to 10th, does it? So how does that work out for you as a pro? Do you get free travel and hotel accommodation when you get there, or are you paying for that out of your own pocket?
No, for me, I'm a pro in the very loose sense of the word, I suppose, that I don't make a living off triathlon. Unfortunately, it doesn't actually pay my bills yet.
Yeah.
So, there's little bits of accommodation help on offer at some events, but not massive because I'm not a I don't know, a big name in triathlon. I'm not a Frodeno or a Gomez or anyone. So whether I race their events or not, it probably doesn't make much odds to the organisers in terms of promoting it.
Right. So in that sense, then, when you go to a race, you're pretty much like an age grouper. You're covering your own costs. You know, you have to get back early to go to work, maybe not the next day, but you still have those same work commitments the next week. You're not sort of like delaying your travel back, and you come back having, you know, I don't know. Do your wife and children come with you, or is it just you that goes?
No, the children don't come anymore. My wife comes to, she comes to most of the events, especially if they're in the UK. The kids come to some of the ones in the UK, but not all of them.
Okay. So I know you've got sponsors. Good opportunity for you to shout out your sponsors. Do you want to run through those?
Yeah, I get some really good support from my kit and that from the guys at Rayskin. I get wheels from Revolver Wheels, nutrition from OTE, and wetsuits from Blue 70.
Okay, again, most age groupers would think, oh, that's good, getting sponsored. There's probably a bit of cash on offer there. Do you get any cash from your sponsors, or is it mostly kit?
It's mostly kit with a little bit of cash on performance bonuses. So I don't get any upfront money from anyone.
No. What about a bike? Do you have to buy that yourself?
Yeah, I bought my bike, yeah.
Yeah. Have you tried to find sponsorship from a local bike shop or from a manufacturer?
I actually get brilliant support from Rycol Cycles in Weymouth, my local bike shop, in terms of servicing and repairs and stuff like that on my bike. And they support me with that. You know, like disposables with chains and tires and stuff like that. But in terms of getting support from a bike manufacturer, I have attempted but not got anything. And then it's a bit of a thing between, you know, maybe you could get a deal on a bike that wasn't quite suited for you. So I'm not too keen to compromise what I use equipment-wise for the sake of just being sponsored.
Okay, yeah, I understand that. There is all that. We'll give you this bike, and it's like, I don't really want that. I remember we went to the Liège Bastogne-Liège Sportif recently. Did that on the Saturday, and then the Sunday you go to the sign-on, watch the pros leaving, and they're all milling around the square there before the parade out of town. And there were the guys from I think it was Aqua Blue, and they were riding single chain sets with 11 speed, a bit like some of the mountain bike and cyclocross.
Yeah, I've seen
now.
That on the races this year, them on the single ring up front.
And I remember looking at and thinking, is this a sponsor requirement that they ride that? You know, has somebody got something to promote and wants the team to be specifically riding those? And how do the riders feel about it? You know, because I could see why that might work on a flat course, but on a hilly course like Liège, where you've got a lot of climbing and some steep climbs, you'd need quite a big ratio, and then I guess the gears would be jumping around a bit if you've only got a selection of 11 different gears. So I guess that is a consideration: is if you don't have a sponsor, you can sort out your own setup and something that suits you and your performance criteria.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So you work 23 hours a week. You've got 18 to 20 hours of training. You have a coaching business, I understand, as well. How much time do you spend on that each week?
Yeah, that takes 7, 8, 9 hours a week, I suppose, an hour a day.
Yeah. Do you have many athletes that you look after?
I have a few. I don't run a massively commercial coaching business. It's something that started off, locally with a couple of athletes from the local club and has grown a little bit, but it's not something I push it for. You know, huge commercial gain purely because of the time commitment.
Yeah, I know on a course that I was delivering recently, some of the coaches were talking about their own training and they've got jobs as well, and they're trying to pass this level 3 qualification, which is quite demanding in terms of the background study and reading they have to do. And some of them had come to the decision to put their, you know, not racing as pros, but some of them are good age groupers, put their training and racing ambitions on hold a bit because they just found that the amount of energy required to look after people and change the programs and be there so that they got the stuff on time was just, they were having to compromise on something else. So that was the sleep. And when they didn't sleep as much, they were not doing anything very well. Have you found similar?
Yeah, I have to be quite disciplined and organized with my time to make sure that everything gets done as it should.
Mm. So, and if something has to go by the wayside, what is it then?
It's probably kind of, I don't know, maybe what I'd call chill time. Yeah. For me, it can easily be that I finish dinner at finish training at 6 o'clock, and then it's dinner, and then getting the kids sorted for bed, and then it's sit down and do some work on the computer, and then it's straight to bed. There's not kind of an hour in the evening or a couple of hours to watch a film or to watch some telly or anything like that.
Mm. Do you, if you didn't have to work and you didn't have to do the coaching and you really could just concentrate on being a full-time triathlete, how much of a difference do you think that would make to your overall life, and how much of a difference do you think it would make to your performances?
I think physically it would make a considerable difference. I think there's no doubt that, being able to just sit down between sessions and literally do very little would make a huge difference to the way you'd be able to perform in subsequent sessions, and then, the overall training effect of your program. But I think mentally, I don't know what I'd do with myself, because you'd have quite a lot of thinking time, and I quite like the fact that I'm busy because it just keeps me occupied.
Yeah, yeah. My business partner's Jack Maitland too. Jack's made a name for himself as a coach, but I remember when I first met Jack, he was probably similar to you, actually. He was racing on the professional triathlon circuit there worldwide. This was before the WTS and what have you, before even drafting racing came in. He was aiming for the Commonwealth Games in Manchester, and I remember he'd given up his job, and he was telling me that being full-time meant little things that he never considered, like after a swim session, he didn't have to gather his stuff together, get on his bike, race across town, grab a bagel at the shop and a coffee, and then go to work. He could take his time about having breakfast. Everything was just a bit more relaxed, and that gave him a bit more space, if you like, and just reduced his stress somewhat, which I think he found added to his performance. Would you concur with that?
Yeah, exactly that. You know, for me, as you said, it's very similar to any other age group. I'll get up and I'll run before work in the morning, and then I'll come home and I'll literally have like 30, 40 minutes to get myself sorted, get breakfast and get back out the door before going to work. Mm. I typically go from work straight to the swimming pool, and then come back for a lunchtime swim, come back, have lunch, and then I'm either doing the school run or, doing some work on the computer and that. So it's just flat out throughout the day, and you find that actually the time you get to sit down and do not a lot during the day is generally just meal times.
Yeah. And with all of that busyness in your life, do you ever find that you have to just drop the training sometimes because you just don't have the energy, or you realize that you'd be better off having a nap for half an hour rather than going out for a run?
Yeah, definitely. And if a session's going to be compromised, the thing is, if I have a session planned and it kind of has to happen at, say, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because there isn't room for it to happen at 4, 5 or 6 if I don't feel very good at 3.
Mm.
So I don't have the flexibility, that kind of flexibility, to be able to go, well, do you know what, I'll just have a sleep for an hour and then have a go at it later. Generally, well, actually, the time later is taken up, so it kind of has to happen now or not at all.
Right. Yeah, and I guess, there are certain non-negotiables in your life. You probably haven't got much more negotiation room left with your boss. You don't want to miss the experience of your children growing up, because you've got quite a young family, haven't you?
Yes, yeah. Young children.
Yeah. So, and obviously you want to spend time with your partner, and I guess you've got friends that you like to see from time to time. So there's all of those considerations that go into the mix. Is there any bits of your training that don't get done? Like, you've not mentioned strength and conditioning or things like yoga. Do you get any of that done, or are they things that you just don't have time
for? Yoga is something I'd like to do, but is it probably a time thing, because it's not something I'm not very good at doing that kind of thing at home. I'd be much better going to a kind of class and doing it.
Yeah.
Strength and conditioning is relatively convenient because I tend to just get out the pool and go straight in the gym.
Okay.
So I can combine that into one session.
Yeah.
I generally get it all done, and if I can get a good week in, it works very well when it works, but it almost has to work like clockwork to work.
Yeah. Okay. And nutrition, everybody talks about hacks these days and little shortcuts. Have you tried anything fancy with your nutrition that might sort of give you the equivalent of an extra couple of hours training, or are you fairly standard on what you consume?
I've listened to things like that, and I listened to your podcast with Dan Plews the other week, and he's someone who I follow quite closely because I think some of the stuff is what he says is interesting. But it's not something I'm willing to try and implement quite heavily at this point of the year.
Yeah.
So nutrition-wise, I'd say I'm relatively standard. I think I eat well when I eat healthy. And it's another thing that I always have to do. I always have to have tomorrow's food prepared today, because cooking time generally during the day just it doesn't exist. So I do a lot of my eating out of a Tupperware pot. But as long as I've got it prepared the day before, then it works. If I then don't have it prepared the day before, that's when things start to
That's a good skill to have. I mean, we were having a discussion about what sports nutrition, and I sometimes think people think it's all about, you know, how many carbs you eat during a bike ride and what gels you have. And for me, good sports nutrition is no different than normal good nutrition. But in order to get it right, you have to plan ahead, and you have to put the same effort into planning your nutrition as you do into planning your training.
And that's something that I've learned and had to implement. You know, it's not uncommon for me to go out the door for work in the morning with three lunch boxes full of food, because I've got one for breakfast to eat, you know, at work, and then I've got one to eat before I go swimming, and then I've got something ready for straight after swimming.
Yeah,
but it means I don't really eat a lot of meals cold, but I've learned to deal with that.
Well, that's okay, isn't it? But it's good. Yeah. It's a good habit to get into, to plan your food ahead and to sit down at the beginning of the week. And I guess do you have to plan your food separate from the family then, because you know, because I guess most fathers would come in and most parents would come in and they'd often cook and have what the kids are eating when they're not that young.
Yeah, some meals I do and some meals I don't. It depends what the schedule is for the day and if the kids have got clubs or something in the evening as well. So, but I generally make sure that kind of I at least have three meals prepared a day in advance.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Oh, that's good.
So then, I don't have to think. I don't have to think about what shall I eat. Or, you know, it's there, it's ready, it's in a box. It's normally got a fork in the box as well, so I can just eat it and then crack on.
Yeah, I'm just sort of doing a lot more nutrition studying, and a lot of the stuff we're looking at from a coaching perspective is about making time to get the right food in, making time to prepare your food, making time to sit down and eat it without sort of, you know, shoveling it down in front of the telly. And just getting into good habits as much as anything. There's nothing really clever about the food you're taking in. Just getting into good habits of preparation and really avoiding, I suppose, really avoiding too much processed food is the one big thing.
Yeah. Stir fries. I eat a lot of stir fries because they take 5 minutes in the wok.
Yeah.
You know, I get a bag of, say, sweet potatoes, and I'll bake the whole lot. And then I can literally bag, and I'll cook up a whole pack of chicken or something. So then I know that I can literally bash the veg in the wok. I've got the potato cooked to add in and the chicken cooked to add in, and then I'm good to go in 5 minutes.
Yeah, and do you do a lot of, like, if you have a bit of time on a Sunday then, do you do a lot of batch preparation in advance? So you could chop, I guess you could chop up all your vegetables so they're all in a Tupperware thing. So, you know, you do it all in one go, and then you can just tip it into the wok rather than having to start afresh for each meal.
Yeah, definitely. If I get a chance to do that kind of thing, you know, it's not uncommon to load the fridge up or the freezer up on a Sunday night with food for the week.
Okay, so here's a question for you, Kit. And it's a challenging one. And don't feel I'm having a go at you or anything like that. But you said earlier that really racing is for your own challenge and satisfaction, and that you're not making really benefiting financially from being a pro triathlete. So what's the difference between racing in the same race as an age grouper and coming home and winning the event and being the best age grouper there and all that that carries with it, and racing as a pro and coming 10th?
Well, there's probably a lot less to shout about by racing as a pro and coming 10th. I mean, my best result in a professional 70.3 field is 7th, so I've not even got on a podium yet as a professional. A race of that kind of standard.
Yeah.
But it's the challenge, I think. You know, that's where I aspire to be one day. That's right. Where I want to be, and that's what I'm working towards. And it may not have been this beautiful, smooth trajectory from age group to pro, but, you know, in my head, I'm young enough and I've still got enough potential in front of me that's achievable. And that's what I want. And I'd rather start building the experience and taking the rough with the smooth now. So then when I get there, hopefully it'll be pretty sweet.
Yeah, I guess I'm asking because there will be age groupers that are in the same situation as you. They're good enough to win their age group. They'll be like that Kyle Buckingham story I touched on earlier. They're good enough to win their age group. They perhaps think that they've been to the World Championships, having won that, you know, they've performed quite well there. There's not much of a challenge left for them if they've done all that and they want to go up. But it's, you know, turning pro doesn't just open up a sort of a cupboard full of riches, does it? It's challenging in its own right and not necessarily the sweetness and light that everybody think it's going to be.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I've had more bad races since racing as a pro than I did as an age grouper. When I was racing at an age grouper, I think for my first something like 6 Ironmans, they successively got quicker. No matter what course I raced on, you know, I improved every time I got quicker. And then my first professional Ironman was something like my slowest Ironman in 3 years.
Mm.
So all of a sudden, you kind of have to suck up this different side of it. But
was that due to the pressure of being a professional, or was that just bad luck?
I think it was probably the pressure I put on myself in training, thinking I was racing as a professional.
Mm.
Therefore, I had to do more. I had to do things, you know, bigger, better, faster, and probably just put myself in far too much of a hole to then perform well on race day.
Okay, that's interesting. So, we've been on the line now for a good 40 minutes, Kit. So, probably time to draw it to a close. But let's say there was somebody else in your position, male or female, that was wanting to turn pro. If you could give them some bits of advice, what would they be? I mean, they could go back through this podcast and probably pick it out for themselves. But if we could give them 3 or 4 pieces of advice and things they perhaps ought to consider before pressing the button, what would they be?
I think if you've got the motivation to do it, and then I think Ironman or long course triathlon is a sport that allows you to do it because it's a sport that rewards consistent hard work. So if you're committed to the hard work, then I think you can do it. But I think you need, I think I kind of thought I could just keep doing what I was doing and it would work if I just did more of it. But definitely, you know, in hindsight, maybe consulting, getting advice and getting some coaching from someone with experience at that level sooner would take away from making a lot of those mistakes yourself and hopefully avoiding them.
I guess from what you've said as well, you have to have a 3 or 4 year plan to get to the level you want to be, because it's trying to do that overnight based on what you've said about your experiences is just going to end up actually making things worse.
Yeah, definitely. And I think in my head, the moment I was a professional, I was almost a lot more professional pressure on me to, you know, well, if I don't train 20 hours a week this week, then it's not good enough. You know, 19 and a half didn't cut it type thing. But
right,
just because, you know, a pro has to train 20 hours a week, but it's not that black and white, is it? It's not that simple. And as long as you're progressing, then I think that's what really counts.
Cool. Well, Kit, it's been great. Thanks. I really appreciate you giving us a very honest insight into the life of a professional, the real life, and probably more reflective of most professionals than me sitting here and speaking to Alistair or some of the other people that we see on the TV regularly or read about in the magazines, and also that journey from age grouper to professional triathlete. I do know that your life as a pro is helped along its way by sponsors and the goodwill that they show to you. So I'm going to give you another chance just to repeat some of those, or maybe I can do. So you talked about Racekin. They supply your clothes, don't they? They're based, I know Colin actually, he's a friend of mine. They're based in Huddersfield. So when people see you crossing the line at races, you're in your Racekin kit, and I guess you're training that throughout the year.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliantly distinctive. You've done some phenomenal designs for me over the last couple of years.
And actually, you've got a cool new design for this year, I think, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah, it's stunning. It's so cool. We just said, because obviously we have the pink and blue colours, so we just said pink and blue, do what you want, make it as bright and loud as you can, because you've got to stand out in the sea of black tri-suits. So.
has it been designed around Colin's fondness for the tattoo art type thing?
Yeah, I think it has, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And have you debuted that at a race yet?
I've raced once this year. I did a more local kind of half Ironman race 3 weeks ago. 2 weeks
okay.
ago.
Have you got a picture on your Instagram or on,
yeah, I have, yeah.
Yeah, so where will people see, follow, because I'll be put this on the show notes, but if people want to follow you on Instagram, what do they go for?
Yeah, it's kit_walker_try.
Okay, so that's you on
Twitter
Instagram.
And Instagram. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you've also got another Yorkshire sponsor there, OTE for your nutrition, based in Leeds.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. Never had a kind of a gastro problem during a race since I've raced on them, and on an Ironman I race purely on gels, so taking 20 gels in a day is not a problem.
Yeah, I think I've one of my early podcasts with Nigel Mitchell, who's done some advisory work with OTE, and he made a point of talking about the pH neutral approach to their products, which is supposed to help with your GI things on race day.
Yeah, really clean, really fresh tasting, just nice natural flavours, and just goes down really well.
Okay. Another one then, I'm fond of Blue 70. I've just got my new 2018 Helix, which is had the first swim in it the other day. It's a lovely suit.
Mine got through the door this week, but I've not swam in it yet.
I'll be interested to share some private notes with you on that one, because it's got some subtle differences on last year's.
Yeah, no, I've swam in last year's this year, if that makes sense. You know, I have done some open water swimming this year, but I've not taken that one. So I might take it in the sea this weekend if I'm brave enough.
Okay, and then did you mention somebody that supplies you with wheels?
Yeah, Harry Walker at Revolver Wheels.
Okay, yeah.
He makes he's another Northern based out of Newcastle, handmade carbon aero wheels with a lot of kind of background and aero testing and stuff that goes into it. They're brilliant, brilliantly fast wheels.
Great. So you won't be making many trips up north to see your sponsors, I guess, if you're living in Weymouth.
Well, no, it's just they're all at the other end of the country, but it's a brilliant setup I've got, and everything I've got just works. You know, when things just work flawlessly, then it's the best.
Yeah, and I guess that from a sponsor's point of view, what do you, in terms of, because I'm going to be talking to Amy Kilpin, who's also a race skin athlete, but Amy's an age grouper, does really well with sponsorship, but because I think she knows how to work the system. What sort of demands on your time do your sponsors ask for in particular?
I don't know Amy personally, but you know, I've seen her on social media and stuff, and she seems to be very good with her social media, which is something I'm not quite so good at. But it's a lot of, it's some, you know, interviews for blogs and articles online, and a little bit of media work, and then a lot of social media stuff.
Yeah, so just a presence at being like more like an ambassador, really.
Definitely. Yeah, you know, product, I don't have to do appearances and stuff at events yet. So.
Great. Well, Kit, so you talked about your Instagram and Twitter. Any other places where people can find you?
Yeah, just on Facebook. If you search Kit Walker Triathlon, it should come up.
Okay, brilliant. Well, what's your next race then? Outlaw, or have you got something in between now and then?
I'm racing an event in the Brecon Beacons in June, and then Outlaw Holcomb Half beginning of July.
And then Outlaw Full? End of July?
Maybe.
Okay. Right. Sorry. Yeah, you did say earlier. Right. Yeah. Cool. Well, I'll see you at Holcomb. I'll be there commentating this year. So look forward to seeing you there. Thanks very much for being on the discussion today. It's been great. As I say, a fantastic insight into the real life of a professional triathlete. And very best wishes for 2018. Look forward to seeing you out there.
No, thank you for having me.
And listeners, thank you for being with us yet again. Another great guest, and I'll have more great guests coming up in future weeks. But for now, from me and Kit Walker, thank you very much for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your week. Bye-bye for now. That wraps up this week's episode. I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to listen to the conversation today. And I hope you learned at least one thing that you can put into practice in your training. Now, if this was your first time listening, please go back and listen to our previous episodes. I can guarantee that they will be just as good as you heard from today's guest. If you've listened to all the episodes so far, then thank you so much for continuing this learning journey with me. As you might be aware, reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review and a rating on iTunes or Podbean. You could also follow me at the same time. I also have a free gift for you. In 30 years of competing in triathlon and 20 years of coaching, I've learned an awful lot from my own experiences and from some of the guests who have and will appear on this show. And I feel it's my duty, as I approach the latter stage of my coaching career, to share these with you. So I've put together 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies, and I've squeezed them down into just 2 pages of content. And in order to get hold of this, all you need to do is email triathlonsuccess.com. to beth@thetriathloncoach.com, and she will send it right back out to you. You could also think about joining my Facebook community. It's called the Triathlon Coach Cafe.
We've got over 2,300 members just like you, eager to find out more about how to improve their training and share their successes with people. It's free to join, but you will have to ask. So go along there, answer the questions, and then we'll even do a little video each week to answer your questions. Finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe using Podbean or iTunes. We release new episodes every Wednesday. So that's all for now. See you again next week, same time, same place.